Welcome to the Just North School of Justice podcast. This is the first podcast in a two-part series on justice theory. As global climate change is increasingly impacting every population in every corner of the earth, the Arctic comes increasingly into focus, with the Arctic climate warming at a rate of four times faster than the rest of the world, and also as an important source of critical raw materials. Discussing a variety of themes, from climate action to economic development, from political representation to access to energy, from new innovative policies to their actual implementation and feasibility, Just North podcasts try to uncover the complexities and the possible solutions in working towards a just, ethical, and sustainable transition in the Arctic. This podcast focuses on the applied theories of the School of Justice, which we have discussed in a previous podcast produced by Just North. This podcast brings together members from the Just North team of scholars who have been working with these theories of justice and discusses theories related to environmental and climate justice, landscape justice, and spatial justice. Let's start this podcast with a contribution by Dr. Stefan, who discusses what is exactly spatial justice and why it matters.
Spatial justice is most simply an approach used to frame situations of justice or injustice. Spatial justice can then be thought about as a methodology, one that uses spatial concepts to illustrate where conditions of injustice are produced and where they are experienced. Theories of spatial justice have been in development throughout the past five decades and encompass a range of disciplinary and ontological approaches to understanding justice. Three general conceptual approaches in particular can be pointed to in the development of the concept. Early forays into theories of spatial justice were inspired by mainstream theories of liberal justice emerging in the early 1970s. At this time, geographers and urban planning scholars applied theories of distributive justice, or those seeking equity in distribution, to express justice in terms of fairness in territorial allocation. Equity in territorial allocations of public goods and bads were mapped and regional comparisons were made, which sought to illustrate, for example, how one city region was underserved as compared with another. Distributive theories continue to play a role in spatial justice frameworks today, but conceptual advances in justice theorizing have pushed spatial justice beyond the matters of distribution alone. A second approach, which developed in the early 2000s, relied upon more sophisticated analyses of space. Inspired by the thinking of geographer Edward Soja, who in turn was influenced by the spatial thinker Henri Lefebvre, space is described not as a container where things simply happen in, but as a product of social relations. Soja's concept of the socio-spatial dialectic bears this notion out by suggesting that relations produce space, while in turn, space reflects back on social relations, affecting people within certain spaces and places. Such thinking on space offered a conceptual framework to then assess injustice. From this perspective, spatial justice is seen as derivative of social justice and emphasizes how certain groups of people are affected by specific spaces. And segregation is a common example of spatial injustice, for one can identify how certain social, political, and economic processes lead to segregated housing areas within a given place, and in turn, how people residing in such spaces are or are not able to access certain goods or services or establish a general quality of life compared with others. This general approach to spatial justice relies upon a relational notion of space and social practice and remains today as a popular way of framing injustice. A third approach to spatial justice theorizing has come about more recently. Unlike early justice theories, which focused on matters of distributional equity alone, theorists influenced by feminist and critical or radical approaches to justice theorizing have made explicit calls for giving more normative attention to framing matters of injustice. That is, rather than seeking to establish ideal principles of justice to indicate whether something is just or not just, scholars have argued for more substantive conceptions of justice, conceptions which evaluate the concept of justice and injustice more so as a process dependent on democratic engagement and evaluation and one that pays attention to the situations of injustice. Instead of identifying what justice is, then, spatial justice or spatial thinking has sought to show where injustice may be situated and from where conditions of injustice derive. Common to all three of these approaches, then, spatial justice relies upon an understanding of geographical space as that which is socially produced. And what follows from this is that social injustices take spatial forms, as space is a product of social relations. To situate or place spatial injustice, the related concept of scale helps to frame a domain in which injustices can be analyzed. As a methodology, therefore, spatial justice is useful to researchers for describing the organization of geographical space as domains of injustice. And in this way, the concept of spatial justice is a helpful analytical tool for describing and evaluating matters of injustice within and among places.
In the next part of this broadcast, Dr. Johanna Holson from the Institute of Russian and Eurasian Studies of Uppsala University explains the concepts of environmental ethics and environmental justice, essential theories that lie at the core of the research we conduct here at Just North.
In this podcast, you will get a brief two-in-one introduction in that we are discussing two distinct traditions developed in or through environmentalist movements. The first tradition is environmental ethics, and the second is environmental justice. These two traditions are associated via their connection to the environment, but they have largely developed in different contexts, with different starting points, different politics, and separate approaches to questions of ethics and justice. There is often no easy compatibility between environmental ethics and environmental justice, but there is potentially a valuable complementarity between them. For instance, both are necessary for any just and ethically defendable conception of sustainable development. Now we will center on two points of divergence, which will be the tradition's disciplinary domains and their main focus. So let us start with the first point, the disciplinary domains. Environmental ethics is primarily developed as a sub-discipline of moral philosophy and ethics, yet later also used, studied, and discussed beyond philosophy. The early ideas grounded in environmental ethics are often traced back to ancient times in philosophical thinking of Aristotle or Confucius, but they regained attention in the 1970s through the development of ideas about a land ethic, first outlined by Aldo Leopold in the 1940s, but especially through the work of deep ecology philosophers like Arne Naess. Environmental ethics is primarily an intellectual undertaking informing policy agendas related to conservation or environmental protection. Environmental justice, on the other hand, was instead initially developed as a social movement that was then picked up in academic work, first by sociologists, especially Robert Bullard, and then by scholars in a range of fields like geography and law. Some argue that environmental justice is, to some degree, a critique of mainstream environmentalism and of the sense of environmental ethics that stands behind it. Environmental justice cannot be understood apart from the moments of grassroots anti-racist civil rights-oriented activism that birthed it. However, much environmental justice scholarship has since, and at times, only been loosely connected to that activism, especially as the concept of environmental justice has been institutionalized and incorporated into the offices, practices, policies, and laws of nation states. Second, the main focus in these two traditions differ. Environmental ethics, as an applied and normative tradition of ethics, primarily focuses on first the intrinsic values of the environment and nature, and second, it looks at humans' place within the environment and nature, including thinking about what the proper places should be. By contrast, environmental justice is primarily focused on human relations, institutions, and structures, and at the role of the environment within these features. Central in environmental justice are questions related to structural racism, oppression, and marginalization of some groups of people, issues not given much attention in environmental ethics. Environmental justice is inherently social and societal, while environmental ethics primarily tend to focus on the individual, human, and her relationship to nature. even though this is sometimes challenged from within the tradition, for instance, by social, feminist, and critical approaches of environmental ethics. So despite, or maybe because of these differences, environmental ethics and environmental justice are potentially complementary in that a combined focus on human relations with nature and with each other can offer the possibility to focus sustainable development on both a healthy relationship with the environment and a healthy relationship with each other. So although strong affinities can be seen between environmental justice and environmental ethics, they approach questions of the environment in very different ways and for very different reasons. However, they both contribute in important ways to discussions of justice, the environment, and of sustainable development for the Arctic.
But this is not all. When talking about these issues, justice, the environment, and sustainable development, the word climate would easily come to our mind. But what is climate justice exactly? In the next part of this podcast, a conversation between Dr. Tracy Skillington from the Department of Sociology and Criminology of the University College Cork and Dr. Patrick Mahoney, Senior Lecturer in Sociology at University College Cork, will shed some light on the concept of climate justice. Dr. O'Mahony is also an author of a major book on the contemporary theory of the public sphere of 2013, and its primary focus on question of the environment and on the social implication of new technology.
My name is Tracy Skillington, and I'm here today with my colleague Patrick O'Mahony to discuss very briefly the topic of climate justice. Patrick is a senior lecturer in sociology here at University College Cork, and is also vice chair of the social science panel of the EU's Marie Curie programme. So Patrick, thank you very much for discussing this topic with me today. Let me just begin briefly by noting a few points, in particular, how climate justice over the years has come to be defined more specifically as a human rights concern. For instance, the right to health, freedom, quality of life, security, the rights of the child, etc. And in this sense, increasingly, climate justice becomes a more legally significant discourse. However, paralleling these developments are other very disturbing tendencies that appear to contradict this normative project. Yet such contradictions have not been granted sufficient political attention to date. For instance, the fact that no world region at present is on track to meet the terms of the Paris Agreement, as the findings of a recent Climate Action Tracker report make clear. The current climate actions of the EU27, for instance, are still incompatible with the terms of the Paris Agreement. Its 2030 emissions reductions target of 40% has been singled out by experts as wholly inadequate. Yet, is it capable of implementing the recommended 65% reduction when year on year it proudly announces its expanding rate of production of new cars, etc.? 2021 saw the opening of Germany's largest automobile factory and the largest battery factory in the world, for instance. Together with a lack of sufficient funding of climate actions abroad, which is another requirement of the Paris Agreement, the likelihood of holding warming below 2 degrees Celsius, let alone 1.5, is now under threat. There would appear to be no attempt to address such contradictions in institutional thinking. So my question for you, Patrick, should we then continue to speak of climate justice when perhaps it is more appropriate to frame the debate as one of injustice, since not all peoples have the same claim to equal opportunities to transform the scheme of climate inaction? Over to you, Patrick.
Thank you, Tracy. A very interesting, also a very complex question. To begin, perhaps I could say a few words about how I understand the way in which norm, the idea of a norm, for example, you spoke about climate norm or even rights as norms, are understood in the Western philosophical tradition. And it seems to me that most often these are understood in a highly idealized and fragmented way, whereas as a practicing sociologist with a considerable interest in the theory of society or societal theory more generally, I think that these that various different manifestations of norm, and you mentioned a few, for example, rights norms or pollution emission norms, for example, reduction norms in this respect, these need to be brought together. But they can't be just brought together in some abstract fashion. They need to be brought together in terms of something like a social logic. And from the vantage point of intellectual disciplines, what this calls for is cooperation between those intellectual disciplines that emphasize process over those intellectual disciplines that emphasize nodal phenomena like rights, norms, and so on and so forth, and also incorporating the natural sciences, of course, in this respect. And it has always seemed to me that the climate debate is extremely limited from this vantage point. Particularly climate action tends to focus on these technical norms. International law focuses on the rights norms, and the whole context of application of these norms. There's been a lot of work in sociology, of course, in the context of application of ideals or of norms, but the context of application is largely under-addressed and poorly comprehended. So we don't even know whether we're making progress towards achieving these norms, because we don't know what the true normative complexity in all its respects would be in order for us to meaningfully head in the right direction. So we have this episodic process which is incomplete and unsatisfactory in many respects. Now you ask secondly the related question about justice and injustice. Now, I've been giving attention to this, I must say, for quite a long period, since at least my last book, the one on the public sphere in 2013. And my sense is that here we have a distinction between what we say in the normative and social sciences, a distinction between ideal theory and non-ideal theory. So the ideal theory would have been in the Rawlsian or even perhaps the Habermasian tradition, emphasizing, you know, the centrality of normatively regulated governance and the specification of what we might call affirmative or positive norms around which justice could be organized. Whereas the other tradition, emanating from a new turn in the non-ideal turn in the normative and social sciences, is emphasizing, you know, contestation, disagreement, and so on and so forth. Now, while I have some sympathy for the injustice paradigm, and of course there are a multiplicity of injustices that need to be taken into account, nonetheless, I find injustice without ideal standards to be somewhat inadequate. So I see this distinction somehow between justice and injustice taken too far, and not against the emphasis on injustice, of course, I think it's absolutely fundamental and vital, but taken too far, it reproduces the dichotomies and the contradictions that you alluded to and that I alluded to in the understanding of the normative architecture with which we could conceivably think about climate change. So what we need is, in actual fact, a type of paradigm blending. As Habermas has relatively recently said, you can't really have critique without validity. In other words, you can't have an analysis of justice without some kind of sense of a standard of what justice would be. Yet these two things have to be dialectically interpenetrating. This type of dialectical interpenetration is not just a question for the normative sciences alone, but it's fundamentally a question of the normative and social sciences and the normative social and natural sciences. So I guess that's the summary answer to your long question. I could say a lot more, but that's what I'd say.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Last but not least, Don Mitchell, a professor from the Department of Cultural Geography of Uppsala University, present the theories of landscape justice in episode 4 of the podcast series on Applied School of Justice.
For many of you, the phrase landscape justice might sound a little bit strange. What could these two words have to do with each other? Landscape, of course, is what we see when we go outdoors. It is the view from the hilltop out over the countryside or town. It is the scene before us. And justice, by contrast, is all about fairness, respect, and getting what is due. Except landscape is not only the scene, the view out over the countryside. In the Scandinavian languages, the cognate term for landscape, landskap or landskab, originally named a certain kind of territory. During medieval times, landscapes were territorially defined communities within which a set of customarily defined rights and privileges prevailed. Compared to surrounding manorial estates, they were often relatively free and something like proto-democracies. They were, according to the geographer Kenneth Olwig, substantively places of justice. Places where claims to fairness, respect, getting what was due, and just as importantly, proper punishment for misdeeds were adjudicated. This sense of landscape persists today, not only in Scandinavia, but in the Anglophonic world too. For example, the ship in township is closely related to the scape in landscape. And in many of the United States, legal, policing, and other processes are organized at the township level. In the Germanic languages, the cognate for landscape, Landschaft, also connotes not just the scene, but the morphology, that is, the shape and the structure of the land that comprises the scene. When we talk, for example, about the cultural landscape, we're often invoking just this sense of Landschaft. This way of understanding landscape as, in essence, the humanly transformed environment, transformations that have often been built up historically over centuries, has been particularly important for the field of geography, which has expended a good deal of effort for the last 150 years or so, trying to figure out how humans have made their landscapes, why they have made them as they have, what the landscapes mean, and how people live in them. Of course, to live in a place, to live in a landscape, immediately raises questions of justice. Can we all live fairly in this landscape? Do we all get our due? Does the landscape, the humanly transformed environment, support a good and healthy life for all, or does it undermine it for some, or even many? Despite all this, the landscape is also the scene. It is what we look out or down on. And this sense of landscape, too, is vitally important for understanding the role landscape plays in questions of justice. Beginning in the early Renaissance, as mercantile capitalism based in Europeans' growing plunder of other lands took hold, new forms of property, which is to say new social relations among people and between people and the land, also took hold. Especially in the Venetia terra firma and in the wool-growing and spinning districts of Flanders, the multiplicity of customary use rights that defined access to land were replaced by a new model of private property. Commons were usurped and enclosed, as they soon were in Great Britain too. And their new owners, wealthy merchants and proto-industrialists, needed ways of both defining and depicting their new exclusive proprietorship. Surveying and mapping were vitally important in this, of course, and through them, new ways were invented to represent the land on paper, to depict the entirety of a place on a single sheet, whether as a map or a drawing or both, and in essence, to allow it to be owned in a single glance. Simultaneously, single point perspective was also invented and perfected, which allowed a place to be depicted in something like 3D, as we might say today. A new landed estate could be depicted as a view, or a scene, as a landscape, as in the landscape paintings we are all so familiar with. Being able to represent the land as landscape, the scene, the view, was thus closely aligned with the evolution of private property, the displacement of peasants and villagers from the land, the elimination of their customary use rights to it, in short, all the processes that Marx called primitive accumulation, and the geographer David Harvey calls accumulation by dispossession, which is to say, the way in which landscape is a scene is indissolubly connected to the rise and eventual universalization of capitalism. Given this history, how could landscape not be about justice, or rather, often injustice, especially since, as this history developed, landscapes depicted in paintings and drawings, always an idealization, increasingly became the model upon which physical landscapes were designed and built. Even so, a specific focus on landscape and justice in relation to each other, landscape justice, is a relatively new endeavor, not more than 2 or 3 decades old. Geographers, landscape architects, and others have worked hard to understand how all these senses of landscape, landscape as territory, landscape as scene or scenery, and landscape as built form that encapsulates the social relations, like the relations of property that go into its making, create the conditions of possibility, or for that matter, impossibility, for just societies. How, by analyzing the landscape, can we understand the actual physical shape of justice and its representations? what distributional, procedural, substantive, and perhaps even retributive practices and outcomes get built into the landscape and its representations. To make them more just, what must be changed in the very structure of the landscape, and how should this be decided? Can there be a more just society without changing the landscape? Advocates of landscape justice answer no. In other words, focus must not only be on abstract or ideal notions of distribution, procedure, and so forth, but must be on the landscape itself. What does it, and what does it not allow? What does it obscure from the view that is vitally important for how we organize our societies? These are key questions that the idea of landscape justice raises, but they are not the only ones. We live in and have strong attachments to our landscapes. They comprise part of our heritage. Recognizing this fact, the Council of Europe began in the 1990s to fashion a European Landscape Convention, which has now been signed by most European states. The convention binds its signatories to a set of practices related to the landscape, including mechanisms for preservation, for culturally sensitive development, and for participatory planning. Though scholars have strongly criticized many aspects of the convention, for example, it tends to make community or public participation subservient to the rule of experts, and it underappreciates the role that outsiders, like immigrants, play in producing and maintaining culturally valuable landscapes, they have also understood it to be an important step towards assuring that diverse people's interests in the landscape are recognized, a vital justice consideration. The convention has also sought to offset interests in economically exploiting the landscape with a demand that other values be considered. In critical response to the development of the European Landscape Convention and other developments around the world, for example, the epidemic of land grabbing in Africa, the depredations of war, and more, scholars and practitioners have begun to formulate what they call a right to landscape. To have a right to landscape is to have a right to be centrally involved in its making and its transformation, and in determining its meaning. It is a right to have a place in landscape as territory, and to be seen and heard in landscapes as they are represented. Though in its infancy, this budding discussion on the right to landscape, and on landscape justice more broadly, has significant meaning for Just North and for sustainable development in the Arctic. If in our research, our policies, our political engagements, and our prescriptions for development and change, we start from the dual proposition that first, all peoples have a right to landscape, and second, that the landscape, as humanly transformed nature, encapsulates or makes concrete in its very form the actually existing state of justice and injustice in place, then we can begin to assess how proposed development projects might advance or undermine that right and positively or negatively transform the actually existing state of justice and injustice that the landscape makes so solid, that it builds right into the ground. It can help us understand how any development must be geared towards helping the landscape become a place of justice in that old sense of the Scandinavian terms, landskap and landskab.
Thank you for having listened to this Just North podcast. If you're interested in learning more about schools of justice and of justice theories, don't miss our other podcast on the schools of justice. You can also learn more about this Just North project and its admissions at www.justnorth.eu or follow us with @justnorth.eu on social media channels, including Instagram or Twitter. Just North has been funded under the EU Horizon 2020 Climate Action Program with Grant Agreement 869327. If you're wanting to learn more about justice theory, the team has also published an edited volume that includes more detail about the theories we have discussed today. The book is called Theorizing Justice, A Primer for Social Scientists, published with Bristol University Press in September 2023 in their Spaces and Practices of Justice series.